Inner Voice, a heartfelt chat with Dr. Fujian.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Inner Voice Show. I'm Dr. Fujian Zain and have Sean in studio. This is a show about what matters most in our life, our minds, thoughts, feelings, actions, relationships, and our fulfillment in this beautiful journey of life. So today, I'll be speaking with Dr. Dawn Mechenbaum, the research director of Melissa Institute for Violence Prevention and one of the 10 most influential psychotherapists of the 20th century. He will be talking about resiliency. And then I'll speak with Linda Carroll, who's a couples therapist and a coach for more than 3 decades, and she's the author of Life Skills. So we're going to talk about relationships and how you can create life skills within your relationship and love. So I wanted to also now share the tip of the week and what are some parts of my experience with you. I've been experiencing and talking with many people this week that are experiencing gratitude in a very different way. And I'll share with you how different the two are. I feel grateful for my health, for having an amazing relationship with my husband, for great friendship, for great family members who are always supportive, for clients who are resilient and are up to extraordinary growth, and for my home that really feels like a home, for the nature around that gives me all from the rose bushes, this beautiful and fragrant roses, and the peach and the lime tree that I have out there that are generously fulfilling us with amazing fruit, for all the people who are working so hard for us to be able to work from home, and for all the frontline medical staff that are putting their own lives in danger to protect the life of our loved ones, to all the NGOs which are working tirelessly to fill the gap that is needed, to all of the generous people who are donating money for a good cause, for humanity, and grateful for Sean and everyone at KMET for doing such a wonderful job. And the list keeps going on. I also have had a different experience before, which I remember the days that the feeling of grateful only came to me as a rope to pull me out of the darkness and pain. You know, it sounded like, I know that I should at least feel grateful that the worst possible scenario hasn't happened. You know, like you get into an accident and go, thank God, at least I'm not dead. Or, you know, I'm so grateful that such and such hasn't happened. So there's a difference between the feeling of gratitude from that comes from the expansion of our awareness and heart versus the gratitude that rises from pain. Now, don't get me wrong. No matter where it starts, the destination is great. It's gratefulness, right? So being grateful for life as is, holds a beautiful, calm stance. It's like being content. It keeps bringing us to the present moment. So I wanted to ask you to look at your life for a minute, okay? What are you grateful for? Come up with 5 right now. And are you grateful for life that you have as is right now? Or is it like you're hoping that it will change? Or you like change, but you're also grateful. So it starts from gratefulness and then expands. And what do you need to be grateful for in your life right now? If you were going to be grateful for what you have, what would have to change inside of you? Or what would you have to say to yourself? So please check in different areas of your life and see what you can accept and feel grateful for and what it is that you are resisting and not seeing the benefit or the beauty in. So accepting and starting from a space of gratitude for every area of life will give you a sense of peace that you can assess in how to move toward creating what you want in the areas of life that you want to change in with grace. So right now, also look at what's going on with coronavirus. If you're still at home, if you're listening to us, and the states and the cities have asked you that you can go back to work, the things that you have, the things that maybe you've learned through this maybe past 30 days, if you've gotten the coronavirus and you're healthy now, if you know, your family members have had it and you're moving forward, If you have lost someone or lost your job or are going through the loss and the grief that you're going, still, if you could look at all of those as coming to terms with life and the grandness that it has and all the ups and downs that it has, and is there a way that you can still, with all that's going on, with the good and the bad and everything, feel that expansion of your heart to be grateful for who you are more than anything? For the parts of you who's resilient enough that is going through this in with grace. And thank you for being with us. And I'm grateful that you're listening to us. So we'll be back with Dr. Donald Nahimba.
Join the conversation every Monday afternoon at 3 p.m. Pacific for Inner Voice Heartfelt Chat with Dr. Fujian. Dr. Fujian is a radio and TV host, international speaker, psychotherapist, life coach, and the author of Life Reset, The Awareness Path to Create the Life You Want. She brings you the latest research and interviews with experts in the field of cognitive sciences. Anyone who loves to grow and create growth for humanity gets a voice on this call-in show. Inner Voice Heartfelt Chat with Dr. Fujian. Monday afternoons at 3 p.m. Pacific on Smart Talk KMET 1490 AM and on KMET1490AM.com.
Welcome back to the Inner Voice Show, and I'm Dr. Fujian Zain, and I am so excited to have Dr. Don Mechenbaum with me today. He is currently the research director of the Melissa Institute for Violence Prevention in Miami. He was voted one of the 10 most influential psychotherapists of the 20th century, and he is one of the founders of cognitive behavioral therapy. He has made his book, Roadmap to Resilience, available for all of you for free. You can go to roadmaptoresilience.wordpress.com. He is one of the world leaders in the areas of stress and resilience. Thank you so much for joining me on my show.
Pleased to be here.
Dr. Mechenbaum, you have devoted much of your academic research career over 50 years to the study of the impact of trauma and victimization and violence and ways to bolster individuals and families and communities' resilience. Tell us about your experience and your findings.
Well, thank you for the invitation. As you know, for over 50 years, I've been involved with a whole variety of populations who have been exposed to various forms of trauma or victimization. This is everything from natural disasters like Hurricane Katrina and Sandy, to various fires, to victims of violence from school shootings, to the 9/11 attack, and also with regard to returning soldiers. The experience that we're all encountering now with the pandemic, coronavirus, COVID-19, presents particular challenges. I guess the major lessons I've learned in those 50 years is while most people are impacted by the exposure to these trauma experiences, when you look at the data, 75% of people who have been impacted will go on in evidence resilience, that is the ability to confront ongoing adversities, while 25% sort of get stuck, either due to vulnerability or absence of supports. So what we've been able to learn is that resilience and trauma experiences co-occur. And moreover, sometimes people are resilient in one domain and not in other domains, or at one time and not others. But what we know is that all individuals can be helped to become more resilient. I'd be happy to share with you some of the ways, the building blocks that nurture resilience that people can now use confronting the impact of losses, stresses, and deaths co-occurring with the coronavirus.
Absolutely. There, in some of the book that you wrote and your findings, as you said, some people
will have the post-traumatic stress, and some people will actually have post-traumatic growth. What does it take for a person to go from the stress to the growth?
We need to identify the nature of the building blocks in terms of physical, interpersonal, emotional, cognitive, behavioral, and spiritual. That's sort of what I've put online in the Roadmap to Resilience website that you indicated that people could access. So in order, it's not an either or proposition. At times people can be resilient, and other times they can be rather stressed out. It's not an either or, these things co-occur. But when we look at the building blocks, let me deal with each of those in turn of what people can now do. Physical well-being or fitness is key. So we now know that being able to move around, to do exercise, whether it's online in terms of yoga or some other form of exercise, that not being a couch potato is really key. That looking after one's physical well-being in terms of hygiene, in terms of sleep behavior, are all critical to moving into that resilient phase. Moreover, one of the things that becomes important as a key block of all this has to do with interpersonal social supports. It's very hard to be resilient by yourself. We know that the people who get stuck tend not to share their feelings. They tend to feel isolated and lonely. In fact, loneliness, feeling as socially isolated, is one of the most important predictors of being stuck, of having hot spots. So one of the things that becomes really important is for people to identify people they can now share their feelings with, share their interests, whether it's on the internet by distance, or whether it's with intimates that they now share. It's not really social distances that we're talking about. We're talking about physical distance. Social intimacy, social contact, even though it may not have physical hugs and the like at this time, are key to becoming a thriver instead of a victim. Let me mention one other before I open it up to your further questions, and that has to do with the emotionality. It is very logical and normal for people, given the circumstances of the pandemic, to feel a whole variety of negative emotions, of anxiety, fear, given the uncertainty that whether this will last for long or not, given the sense of fear of being infected, feeling guilty or shame, feeling grief. These are all co-occurring emotions that people may have. These are normal. It's not that you have these negative emotions. It's what you do with those emotions that becomes the critical component as to whether you become a thriver or not. So if you stuff the feelings, if you don't share the feelings, if you try to push the feelings away as compared to tolerating, accept, living with these kinds of emotions, no emotion will be lasting forever. The degree to which you can name and tame the emotion and see it go up and down, the degree to which you can use a variety of procedures like mindfulness. The mind loves to hang around in the past and be preoccupied with the uncertainty of the future. So the degree to which you could attend to the present and preoccupy yourself in that way becomes an important component to become a thriver, to become able to cope in spite of. There are other components of this that we could chat about in terms of thinking, behavioral, and most importantly, spiritual. The major way that people in North America cope with trauma of any sort is to use some form of religion or spirituality. And I'll talk about that in a moment for you.
As you were talking, this came up for me, where many of the people who become traumatized, and they are in the midst of the trauma or a lot of stress, they get scared of their emotions. So as you were sharing about what supports them in order to name it, to tame it, and then be with it and release it, do you have any suggestions for people who get scared of the depth and the intensity of their emotion, and their natural instinct is, no, I'm running away with it, I'm pushing it down, I don't ever want to feel that. How would you suggest for them to embrace it?
One of the things that becomes interesting is there's a kind of boomerang effect. So the more we try to push thoughts or feelings from us, they tend to have a boomerang and become even more intense. So it's these emotions will eat away at us. And the question is, how do we tolerate these emotions? You know, there, if you look at people's coping styles, you could sort of look at it as a kind of simple 2x2. There are those events that are changeable, that we could take some direct action and try to problem solve, to have particular specific goals that are doable, attainable. And there are those aspects of a situation that are unchangeable. Now, the other part of the equation is there's the direct action that we could do something, or there are those that need palliative coping techniques, using our faith and using our distraction. Keep in mind the serenity prayer, you know, that they use in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, God, give me the serenity to accept that which I cannot change, and the courage to change that which I can. And most importantly, the wisdom to know the difference. Getting back to your question, take the situation of grief, where many people now are having loved ones, and that these people have traumatic bereavement. So in fact, once you go on to the website I put together, I've included in there under Action 36, Appendix A, how to handle grief, how to honor those who died, how to communicate, how to turn one's life into a life that's worth living in spite of the loss. To grieve, to have those rushes of depth, of loss, of unaccountable events, it's human. It's an honor to those who have died. It tells us something about the closeness of the relationship. Your depth of feelings of the person you've lost, of the fear of what we are, conveys your humanity. Given the circumstances that we're in, if you didn't have those kinds of feelings, I would be deeply, deeply concerned. Last item, if I may. For some, it would be really helpful to seek help, either professional or through some religious person or to someone you deeply trust. And asking for help. Remember, you have to give to get. So insofar as you can reach out and help others, maybe practically getting groceries for a neighbor or talking to someone on the phone, that is one way to transform your feelings into a social good.
Wonderful. Dr. Mikhamov, how about people who they have been able to handle what's going on with them, but they have spouses or children or family members, friends, who are out there who really need their help, and right. How can they help others, even at a distance, even with what we do with Zoom or any, you know, FaceTime? How could they help?
The most important thing they could do is to show empathy, to listen, okay? People who are hurting don't want you to come on and say, move on, you'll get over it. They don't need your frontal lobe, your advice giving. They need a good listener. They need compassion. They need you to be non-judgmental. There's a fair amount of research on people who have lost loved ones, children. And they've asked these folks, who's a really good helper? Okay? And it's not someone who's trying to get you to reframe your emotion, to dismiss it, but to allow the person at their own pace and to the point that they feel comfortable. There's a need for you as a helper to recognize that there's a kind of hand, heart that you can provide. You can provide a hand in giving actual practical information to someone, of being physically available to them in some ways, of meeting basic needs of adaptation, of coping. But there's also the heart, and it's your heart to reach out, to show compassion, to convey that we're all in this together. It's also important to remind the person you're helping of their past efforts that have succeeded in actually contributing to change. You need them to focus in on what I call the rest of the story of where in the past they, their family, their community have survived pandemics, losses, and deaths. Can you help them make a gift of what they've learned? How do you get them to feel compassion for themselves and others?
You have spoken about different type of stresses, a changeable stress, a non-changeable stress, and different ways to cope with each one. Could you say more about that?
Well, you know, when I was citing the Serenity Prayer, one of the things that becomes interesting is how to have a match between what kind of coping technique you're going to use and the nature of the stressor. So if you constantly try to change something that's unchangeable, that mismatch is going to exacerbate the stress that you experience. So the interesting question for the person is, can they mentalize? Can they think before they act? You know, one of the things is that everyone who's listening to this is not only a Homo sapien, but they're also what is called a Homo narrant. They're a storyteller. And in order to have PTSD, which is essentially a disorder of non-recovery, because most people recover, people have to tell themselves and other stories. So one of the things that becomes interesting is, can we help people avoid thinking traps? You'll see this on the Roadmap to Resilience website as well. Can we, look, we don't believe everything we read in the paper or that we hear on TV. So let me ask, why do you believe every thought that you have? You know, so how do you mentalize? How do you become an observer of your own thinking process? How do you become an observer of the kinds of reactions that you have with others? That kind of self-awareness, that kind of self-control and self-efficacy helps you get into that 75% group.
Thank you. In 1 minute, anything that I haven't asked and you really want people to know that could support them at this time?
I think that people should recognize that everyone can become more resilient, that this isn't something that's God-given or that someone has genetically, that these are learnable skills and that there are tools and people out there. Not only that, it's sort of like you may have learned to ride a two-wheel bike and not attempted to ride for many years. And now you're going back to ride that bike again. It may be rusty, it may take time, but that skill is within your repertoire. The people confronting pandemics today have the potential of that skill. We're all in this together. And please visit the Roadmap to Resilience website, wordpress.com. to look at very specific suggestions of other folks who have been through trauma and what advice they offer. You too can become more resilient. Thank you for the opportunity to share this.
Thank you so much. And for everyone, please go to roadmaptoresilience.com. It's important to put that dot, wordpress.com, and just gain the wisdom of Dr. Make a Mom. And truly, it's an amazing book. I've gone through it. I learned always learn so much from you. And I'm honored to be part of your group. So thank you. Thank you for
thank you very much.
Take good care. And for all of you, don't go anywhere. We'll be right back with the rest of Inner Voice.
Thank you.
Join the conversation every Monday afternoon at 3 p.m. Pacific for Inner Voice Heartfelt Chat with Dr. Fujian. Dr. Fujian is a radio and TV host, international speaker, psychotherapist, life coach, and the author of Life Reset, The Awareness Path to Create the Life You Want. She brings you the latest research and interviews with experts in the field of cognitive sciences. Anyone who loves to grow and create growth for humanity gets a voice on this call-in show. Inner Voice Heartfelt Chat with Dr. Fujian. Monday afternoons at 3 p.m. Pacific on Smart Talk KMET 1490 AM and on KMET1490AM.com.
Have you ever wished you could just wake up one day, reach across your nightstand, and hit the life reset button? Let's face it, the struggles and frustrations of everyday life leave millions of women and men around the globe yearning for a new way. And the new way is right here in Life Reset, the Awareness Integration Path to Create the Life You Want by Dr. Fujian Zain. You can get it now at Fujian.com or Amazon.com. Life Reset, the Awareness Integration Path to Create the Life You Want. You deserve it.
Take KMET 1490 AM with you everywhere you go by downloading our free smartphone apps found on the KMET website, KMET1490AM.com. You can also go to the Google Play Store or the Apple App Store on your phone to download the free app. Now you can listen live or play any of your favorite programmers' podcasts using your smartphone. Don't miss out on the free KMET smartphone apps. Go to KMET1490AM.com and download your free phone app today.
Are you afraid? Are you getting panic attacks? Are you getting bored and can't stand it anymore at your home? Are you finding yourself in a bind with a relationship at home? Are you wondering what all of the fuss is? And are you determined to guard yourself against all others? Or worried about how am I going to pay my rent or mortgage? In respect to the coronavirus stress, I'm offering a sliding scale online psychotherapy for anyone in California and life coaching to anyone in the world who's suffering financially. Please connect with me at Fujian.com, Fujian.com.
Well, welcome back, everyone, to the Inner Voice Show. I'm Dr. Fujian Zain, and I am here with Linda Carroll. She is the author of Love Skill and her other book, Love Cycles. We're here to talk about love skills, though. While she has worked as a therapist and a couples coach for over three decades and has acquired numerous certificates and degrees along the way, she says that her own 35-year marriage is the primary source of her knowledge when it comes to the cycles of love. And you can talk to, you can actually get more information about her and lindacarroll.com. Welcome to the show.
Hi.
Hi. It is great to have you, and I really enjoyed your book.
Oh, good.
So let's talk about it. Now, one of the things that you say is love is a skill, that we talk about falling in love as if it's like a passive concept, you know, something like falls upon us, you know, and if it shows up, it shows up, and if it doesn't, oh well. You say that love is a skill. It's an inside job, and it's something that it's active, and we need to know and learn the skills in how to do it. So talk to us about what, you know, what it is about the skills that we have to learn, and what is the difference between what you call love and loving?
Well, love is a feeling. And as you say, it's passive. We fall in love. We don't have to do anything. We just fall. And so, it doesn't matter if we're, you know, how much intention we have, how much we put into it. It happened to me at 11 years old. It's just, I fell for someone and it sort of blew me away. Like I was so young at that time to feel those feelings. But love is not enough for a relationship. We can feel those feelings, fall for someone who's totally inappropriate. And we miss red flags because of the download of chemicals and magic love potion. A relationship isn't built on feeling. It's built on a series of so many little things that we do, which I call love skills. And that one of the tricky parts about falling in love is we can fall in love with someone that doesn't have the ability to do the skills, or we can fall in love thinking that the feeling will carry us. I've been married for 30, not to this person I fell in love with at 11, but for 35 years. And I haven't felt love for him every moment of those 35 years, I can tell you. But the relationship has been carried by the fact that we go back to the skills again and again. And then that brings the feelings back.
Very much. And you also talk about, I love this sentence that you wrote, that the wave is not the ocean, that we might go through the ups and downs. Like you just said, they're not all the time that I love someone, but I know that this is only a wave in the bigger picture. And if I get the concept of what the bigger picture is for me, and I think with what I've experienced, not only for myself, but also with clients for so many years, that somehow each person has their own vision of the ocean. When they come together, they have a different set of an idea about what marriage should be, such as, you know, whether they got it from their parents or, you know, they made sure that it wasn't the one that was like their parents, and they envisioned this other fantasy type of, you know, my marriage is going to be looking like this and not like my mother and my father's, but and kind of like a picture of what they think that ocean should be. And then somehow they come in together, well, two pictures, and then they have to kind of bring it together. Can you share a little bit about what this concept of, you know, the distinct difference between the wave and the ocean and what the bigger picture is that we need to constantly look upon versus these ups and downs?
Sure. I think there are two things for me. The wave is not the ocean. I think of as being there are certain moments when and this is a great time to talk about the pandemic with both of those concepts, that there are moments that, like, my husband brought me a latte this morning. He was so sweet. And he said, "What is your day? How can I help?" And then he left, and I went down to get something to eat, and he left all the dishes in the sink. And I felt this moment of outrage, and it was crazy. You know, he, based on what a great morning we'd had, but suddenly it was like, how can he leave this mess? It's such a mess. I don't want to have to do it. Blah, blah. And I started this whole crazy talk to myself. And then I stopped and I said, "Oh, come on. This is just like, this is not a big deal. You're so lucky. Get over yourself." And I did. But that moment, that wave of seeing all the mess, because I'm the kind of person that'll clean the minute I use something, that it's done. And he's laid back. And so I felt the wave of feeling angry and judgmental. And then I said, "Wait a minute, in the big story, I'm so lucky, you know," and that happens with the best. We have the great moment, but that moment isn't enough to carry us. So that's the first question you brought up. The second one is, I think, really relevant right now, because people are quarantined together. And the differences, and often the very differences that we fell in love because of, get exaggerated and start to being annoying and feel really difficult. So every way that we come together, like, what is social distancing? What is cleaning? How do we do grocery shopping? One person wanting to listen to the news all the time and a person not wanting to deal with it. We have those differences that become amplified. And so I think that more than ever, we need skills to manage the ways that we are different and have to work out conflict, or not even conflict, just the differences. So I spend a lot of time with people on that one. How about you?
I do too. I think that a lot of times when I see that there's differences, I think that we learn from each other if we open ourselves to learn. You know, if we see ourselves that, no, it's going to be my way. And that's what I said at the time, that many times I've seen people who they have an idea about, this is how marriage should be, this is what's going to look like. And they set up this scenario, and it's almost like, you know, 90% of the thing is done. I only need 10% to find the person who matches what I tell them to be. And then they have a rude awakening, obviously. But to hold on to that piece that, no, it's got to be my way. And as long as it's not my way, it ain't going to happen. Yeah. And, you know, we see that they go through maybe even multiple marriages and not finding their way. So it's more of the minute they open themselves up. But I think part of what we're talking about is also what you call life, the love cycles. You have a model in your book, Love Skills, that it talks about the stages of relationship. And so the first one is the infatuation that people get, the powerful love potion that everyone feels. And I think it's like the nature's concept of bringing humanity or human being together, or if we had to, you know, if we were completely open to what the other one is, we probably would never get together. So somehow, you know, nature has put something that blinds us completely, and then we'll just kind of, you know, gravitate together, and we have that kind of potion for a while. Can you talk a little bit about the love cycle?
Sure. The first stage I call the merge. It's just what you described so wonderfully, where we know now that it's based on so many chemicals. I mean, the old stories from Cupid and Aphrodite, Cupid's mother, who would say in plays and legends to her son, okay, get that person over there, nail that person. And Cupid would dip his arrow in the potion and send it towards the person, and the person would fall in love who was standing next to him. We know that that love potion is full of real chemicals that change how we look at the person. I think and it's a great feeling, but it's not a great place to make a life decision from. That's the thing I tell people. Enjoy it, but don't change your life. That's stage one. Stage two is we know that that chemical, that potion only lasts 3 years. And that's the first time you fall in love. And every time you fall in love after that, it has diminishing returns. So it lasts less and less amount of time. And then what happens is those differences, which seemed so juicy and delicious, start to become annoying. And in this time we're living in, they get exaggerated, the differences. People move into what I call loops in my book, power struggles, that go on and on and on. Stage three is when we're really stuck in the opposite of stage one. We're in the first stage, we saw everything that was right. And in stage three, we see everything that's wrong, disenchantment. And the fourth stage is deciding, what are we going to do? Do we stay? Do we stay in these power struggles? Do I leave? What are my options? And usually it used to be that I would see people in that stage mostly. Now people come in much earlier in their relationship to do preventative love skills, which is great. But in that fourth stage, unless there's danger, unless it's really a very bad scene, I try to convince people to do a little work first. See how you got here. How did you choose each other? What's your part of the trouble? If you could learn skills, how would that change things? Because sometimes people want to get out of the power struggle and they think it's the relationship, but when they learn skills to navigate the power struggle, then they're happy to stay. And then the fifth stage I call wholehearted, because I think that's what we're here for, is to become more whole and more wholehearted in ourselves. And our relationship is a great teacher for that. And so in wholehearted, we're not, of course, there every moment, and it's not something that lasts forever, but we get more and more familiar with how to come from a wholehearted place. So like this morning, when I went down to the kitchen, I saw all the dishes in the sink and I had this attack of criticism and judgmentalness. It wasn't wholehearted at all, but I caught myself. It was a mindfulness. I said, Linda, that's crazy. This is a small part of a big, wonderful relationship. Get over it. And I did. So wholehearted brings us back to that place, but it doesn't stop us from our human reactions.
Definitely. You also talk about genogram, and you work with your clients and people with the book, you also said, for them to look at that. So can you first explain for people who might not necessarily would know what a genogram is? And then what is the usage of it? As you said, you ask them to look at what's going on inside of them. What is the history that came up for them? Where is it that they learned this or role modeled this from? And it seems like that's what a genogram will do for people. But can you elaborate on what a genogram is and the use for it?
Sure. And it's the first thing I ever learned when I was in graduate school is that when you work with a couple, there are always six people in that room. And that is the parents and the grandparents. To begin with, and we carry on traditions of our family without knowing that we do it. The genogram, and going back in history, and I usually go back two generations, is a great way to see how certain ideas or principles or ways of being that were appropriate maybe a generation or two ago, we're still carrying those out. And especially if our parents were immigrants or they went through all, I mean, when people come from other countries, they bring not only traditions, but ways of staying safe. Don't talk to people outside the family. For a lot of people who came here, just as you, if you had parents or grandparents or great-grandparents, one of the things that often is true is that immigrants come because there is persecution, because there's poverty, and they come because they are escaping something. And so one of the rules is never talk about how you feel or outside the family. And so a lot of my clients are adhering to those old rules. When they come to therapy, they're really breaking the rules when they talk about how they feel. I mean, when you think about what it takes, I have a foundation. I work with a lot of immigrants in Mexico, a lot of migrants. And one of the things I'm always shocked by in their stories is what they had to leave behind to come. And if you feel all of those feelings, how do you get on with a new life? And so it's, you just keep moving. But now we're telling people all the time, feel your feelings. What makes you sad or angry? Express them. Many of us are breaking family rules that go back to a time when that made sense. So that's a big example. But I think we act out in our relationships. We may have had an older sibling who took up all the space. So when we go to dinner with our partner and they get a lot of attention, we might feel a sense that of feeling angry about something. It really isn't about them. And you know that we call that a projection. It's not about them at all. It's about what happened when we were a kid with our older sister. But if we don't have that information, we really think it's about them. So understanding our family history and what those stories are, those beliefs that we're acting out, that we don't know that we're even acting them out. We think it's all lands on the person we're with now.
Definitely. It certainly helps when we have the epiphany and the awareness that many of our behaviors are not necessarily chosen ones at that moment, and they're automatic behaviors and thoughts and feelings that show up because of generation after generations that have been, we lived through it. We've seen it, we've subconsciously picked it up, and some of it we've picked it up as a choice, some of it we've picked it up as a coping mechanism, as a reaction, and it's been such an automatic space for us that we're not aware of what we're doing. Many times I watch myself and even with our clients that, you know, after the behavior is out, after the cat is out of the bag, then suddenly like, oh, what happened? Who was that? Who said that? And it's that kind of an automatic part of us which lives in the relationship and creates a result in the relationship. And by doing the genogram, the awareness of what you're doing, I think it brings a lot more of the consciousness of choosing, decision, and deciding how I need to be in my relationship versus, you know, just kind of like going through life with all of that. You also talk about Enneagram. I have not talked about Enneagram for such a long time, and it's such a pleasure to see it again, which is like a psychological and spiritual came from the Sufism, and they brought it all together. And I remember when I did mine, I was a 2 and an 8, and then went to the 4. And we're probably not going to explain all of that to everyone. We don't have enough time for that. But it was a joy to see that in your work. Can you share a little bit about Enneagram?
Well, yes, because it comes from one of the most important skills is knowing your partner isn't you. Because we think that they're us and that how they react to the world is somehow wrong if it's not the way we react to the world. So the Enneagram is the greatest way of understanding differences without making people wrong. And that's one of the things I love about it. You know, it's 2,000 years old. It's gone on. It's the greatest way of understanding personality I know. And even though I've been studying it for 20 years, people can grasp it very easily, which is different than a lot of the personality tests. But the real gift of that, besides understanding your own lens, is knowing that your partner has a different lens than you do. So, for example, I have a certain lens which goes to possibilities, that whatever happens, I think about all the possibilities it offers. My husband's lens goes to limitations. He's very grounded on the earth. He's exactly how much money do we have? Can we afford this? Whatever that limitation is. And we used to, at first we fell in love with those differences. Then we began to be critical. I would say he's rigid. He would say I'm impulsive. But understanding the Enneagram, I get that in his type, as a one, he likes things to be predictable. He likes things to fall in a certain form, and it makes sense for him. And that it's not that he's negative, or it's not that he's rigid. It's that's how he thinks, and it works in many ways. Whereas for me, it's not that I'm impulsive. It's that I see all the possibilities. It's actually a great balance, but not when we're blaming each other for being different. So I describe the Enneagram, the different types. I give people a lot of resources where they can find out more. But the real bottom line is whether you buy into that or not is your partner isn't you. And being with another person, we really get to find that out when we're locked in together, don't we? How to have empathy for the fact that they see the world in a very different way.
That's very much. It was interesting when I did the Enneagram many years ago. It was a revelation, which was the truth, but I'm not very much into categorizing. I even created a model, which just goes really before, without categorizing. But with all that said, it was awesome to go and do the personality type and find out that when I get very anxious and the world isn't the way I want it to be, I become very controlling. And then when I'm safe and all is well, I become the hopeless romantic. And it was so true.
Yes. Well, one of the films about the Enneagram was called Out of the Box, because the idea was that it releases us when we understand our personality or our partners rather than puts us in a box. It's not that we are not all of the types or that we're not more than that, but it really, I think, gives us a sense of where our attention goes and also where our struggle is. And it's a way to talk about how you are impacted by another person's struggle without making them wrong. And I love that, because we have enough criticalness with each other and ourselves in our world. So anything that can reduce that, I find really helpful.
Yes, it was very pleasant. It was a pleasant surprise when I read it in your graph. So going back to your book, you also talk about a concept you put it in a word, and you said it's called pause, the pause. And you say the P is for presence through listening, and then A, accepting and letting go two things that are true at once. And then the U, undefended communication, the S, speaking with skills and intent, and E, emotional intelligence. So tell us about that, the whole concept of pause.
Well, if you go to retreats, if you go to any kind of mindfulness retreats, you'll notice that during the retreat that the instructor will ring the bell during most conferences, sometime during the day, the bell gets rung and you're supposed to stop at that moment, whatever you're doing, put down your spoon, put down your shovel if you're working in a garden, and close your eyes and check in with yourself. So pausing is a part of mindfulness. And I think that that all love skills start with mindfulness, observing ourselves. So the pause for communication is essential for love skills, isn't it? The first and the number one communication skill is knowing ourselves, knowing when we're reactive, knowing when we're and not responding, and understanding what's really going on inside of us. So pause is sort of the bridge to take us to all of those different places, becoming less defensive. Learning to speak, how we start a sentence has everything to do with what happens on the other end with our partner. You know, beginning with, I have to talk to you, there's something I'm upset about. Like, it's over before it begins. So if you're upset about something, let's say I was upset about the dishes, which I'm not, but let's say I was, and I came rushing up to where my husband's making a watercolor and said, I can't believe you left the dishes in the sink for me. Thanks. Then what? Like, he's going to turn around and say, oh, I'm so glad you shared, honey. Let me fix it. It's not going to happen. So first of all, pause. Check in. What's going on with me? How big is this? How important is this? And if it is really important, then another pause, another breath, How do I bring it up? What's a good time, a good way to do this? Because if I bring it up in a way that creates anxiety in my partner, his response is going to be to protect himself and defend. So I've got to find out a way to even bring it into the conversation. So pause is important for all of that, and it covers all of those skills.
It's a very important concept, as you talk about, because it also allows us to come out of that concept of automatic that I was saying before, which brings you to the awareness of the present moment and seeing what is it that you would choose and decide to do at this point, which is one of the phases of your model, which is, okay, let me pause and really decide what is it that I want to do. You also share about two things, which is one is the magic words. They are, you know, magic words, they're keys that we know that we could get into the heart of our partner, or we could get to their pissy side. It's very, I know those words can really shift. And they're magical ones that can really get to their heart. Mm-hmm. And you also talk about an open conversation versus, you know, to taking one away, such as, you know, if we could accept the differences and share them, and look at both of them, that they could coexist versus it has to be one or the other, which usually comes with and you bring these two, both of those concepts in your book. Can you share with us your views on those?
Sure. The three magic words are tell me more. So your partner comes in and they're an hour late for dinner and you're really upset. So the first thing often our instinct is to say, what happened? Where were you? Dinner was right, like that. If we can take a breath and say, what happened, without attacking, and they'll say, well, I got stuck, and we say, tell me more, we can learn all sorts of things about them and give them a chance. You know, we love to talk, most of us, and we want to be heard, but listening is a real gift. If often a conversation will go like this, my partner will say, I had a really hard time at work. And I'll say, what happened? And he'll say, oh, that person I work with is really a pain. I'll say, I didn't like him either. You know, maybe you should try this. And then I'll tell him a story about someone I worked with. None of that's wrong. But if he says, I had a hard day at work, I say, what happened? He says, the person I work with is really a pain today. And I say, oh, tell me more. It's about him, not me. So what I'm doing is I'm passing the talking stick to him and saying, I'm here to listen. And I might find all kinds of things out about him. And instead of telling him what it's like for him. And so in that process of tell me more, we discover so many, especially when we're judging someone. And instead of starting out with our judgment, to say, what happened for you? Or I'd like to know more about, you know, you were late three times. I'm curious what was up. And it really helps with not just communication, but it helps with creating goodwill in our relationship, which I think is what it's really about.
Yes. We have about one more minute, and I just want to make sure that also I bring this up that you had in your book, which is four transition times, which are so important to connect. You talk about waking up, parting for the day, coming back together at the end of the day, and going to sleep. And if we can't be together, and you know, beyond that, or we wouldn't be able to connect beyond that, I think that more than any time, keeping these four times and really, really being conscious about it in how we want to connect, it's a really a beautiful phases and points that you make. Your last words, something that we haven't said and you really want the audience to know.
I think that a relationship is a great way to become wholehearted. If we're willing to learn the skills, if we're willing to do the work, I think it can take us to the greatest place of wholeness within ourselves, and that everything in the world can change from that.
Wonderful. So everyone, please go to Amazon or go to lindacarroll.com, lindacarroll.com, and I'll put it at the bottom so you can also see it and get the Love Skills book. Thank you so much for being on my show.
You're welcome. Thank you.
And for all of you who are out there, create an amazing life for yourself and everyone around you, even through this time. Bye-bye.